and is open to juniors and seniors. And we will have the exams to hand out at the end of the class period. We'll put them down in front here. And Carl has gone to get them, Jim. I didn't realize they were in the office there. Okay. Elaine Howard asked me to announce some lecture topics that are roughly related to the course subject matter. John Bowen, who is the president of the Canadian InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, is lecturing this week on topics like, has science disproved religion, love, is it really worth the hassle, and so on. These are in Ives 114. And then there's another series that's going to be in Ives 120. The next one is Wednesday night on the topic, the Foolish Lovers Lecture Series. Interesting topic. Anyway, I think there are posters around regarding those if you want more information on them. I have some free advice. If you're over 60, don't climb a ladder and fall off of it. I'm very lucky to be here this morning. I was cutting down a tree and didn't position the ladder quite as well as I could have and fell off the darn thing. Fortunately, landed very, very gracefully and came just very close to either breaking an ankle or my back because there was a big edge of a concrete sidewalk that I almost fell on. Actually, the advice is for those under 60 too. Be careful when you use a ladder. But that bad experience was balanced over the last couple weeks. I learned that my son got into his first choice for graduate school. He got into Yale to do his PhD, and he was very pleased about that. He had applied to Duke, and they accepted 6 out of 248 applicants in the area of religious studies and history. And it was just an awful year to get into graduate school. So some good news and bad news. Also good news, I had a very interesting idea that emerged out of the discussion section on Thursday. Remember, we were talking about nature and about human beings and nature and whether human beings are more worth, are worth more, have more value than other animals. It's one of the fun things about discussion section is that often new ideas emerge out of that interaction. But it dawned on me as we were talking, and I did comment on that briefly in section, that in light of the Plumwood article and the Gilligan article and the Dean Curtin article, it seems to me that the position that human beings are worth no more than other animals or that all animals, including humans, are of equal value is what we might think of as a very typically masculine type position. It's a position that utterly ignores how almost all of us feel and tries to force a highly theoretical, highly abstract principle on our concrete experience and in effect say to hell with our concrete experience and intuitions and feelings. This is the way reality is, so much the worse for those other dimensions of our personalities, because I have never met a person who really believes, I think, or at least is willing to live according to the belief that a human baby, for instance, is not more valuable than a caterpillar. And we would, I think, in general, be very, very leery of such a person. But it suddenly dawned on me as we were discussing this, and I had not thought of it in those terms before, that this is a classic example, and maybe that's why we really suggested the Paul Taylor piece as a kind of counterpoint. This is a classic example of forcing your experience into a kind of Procrustean bed on the basis of a highly abstract theory. Now, that doesn't prove it one way or another, obviously. Obviously, the theory could still be correct. But it seems to me at least it ought to make us a little bit suspicious of the theory when it forces us to do such violence to our ordinary experience and our ordinary feelings about the kind of situation. We simply, I think, in actuality, don't value mosquitoes as much as babies. Now, again, I would remind you that that does not mean then that the mosquito has no value. It simply means that maybe that theory is not the best theory about how to approach human beings and nature. But it's fun when a new idea sort of emerges like that. I'm sure others must have thought about it sooner, but just a classic example of forcing experience into a mold that requires that in a certain sense we do violence to our ordinary feelings and intuitions about those realities. Now I want to go on this morning in a more formal lecture format and address the question, what is nature? We spent time talking about it Thursday. I'd like here to see if we could unpack that question a little bit further. It's a tough question, probably at least as difficult as asking the question, who are human beings or who is God? And one can try to answer the question from many perspectives, from many points of view. The poet, the artist, the astrologer, the mystic, the scientist, the theologian, the philosopher, others have views on this question, what is nature? And indeed, artists and scientists and philosophers approach nature fairly differently from each other. The question that we asked, are human beings a part of nature? Can they be fully comprehended or understood within the category nature and so on? Are they worth more the same as other parts of nature? These are all important questions, and now I'd like to see if I could put them in a somewhat different perspective. I'm very much indebted to an article by Gordon Kaufman, K-A-U-F-M-A-N, which appeared in 1972 in Harvard Theological Review and is called A Problem for Theology, The Concept of Nature. And he suggests something that I think is fairly obvious to us already, that the terms nature and natural are extremely complex terms with a broad range of meanings. The Oxford English Dictionary lists 18 distinct meanings for natural and 15 distinct meanings for the term nature. And these are extremely important terms in philosophy and theology and art, not to mention their centrality in ecology and in environmental thinking. Now the question, what is nature, it seems to me, would be far easier to answer if it were not for the further questions, who is this person who asks the question, what is nature? And how does this person who asks the question, what is nature, herself fit into or relate to the concept nature? That is, I'm suggesting that we cannot ask the question even without some cognizance, some awareness of who are we, because obviously, in some sense, we're a part of nature, and that is directly relevant to answering the question. Now, we might think of human beings in the first place essentially as somatic physical beings, understood essentially according to the laws of physics and chemistry and other natural sciences. And in this case, we would not have too much difficulty thinking of human beings as fully comprehended within the category nature. If the best way or even the only way to study human beings is according to the laws of physics and chemistry and biology, then it would seem fairly believable that we can fully comprehend a human being, human beings within the category nature. On the other hand, in the second place, we can think of ourselves as possessing freedom to choose among various future possibilities. And here, already then, the answer to the question, what is nature, becomes more difficult. Because it's always possible, on the one hand, to suggest, as some have done, that our experience of freedom is basically an illusion. One theory about our experience of making choices, our sense of freedom, is that it doesn't really exist. That what really is going on is simply the inexorable flow of mass and energy, and that the sense we have of making choices is basically an illusion. We are really determined by our heredity and by our environment, and that's the end of the story. Now, I would freely grant that human beings are far less free than the popular stereotypes of freedom, which picture humans as having a kind of license to do what they want to do when they want to do it. I think that the kind of popular image that motivates so much of our culture today, that freedom is just making one choice after another. We discussed this when we looked at Hauerwas. And that there is a kind of core of freedom that we can express in all the different areas of life. I think that's essentially mistaken. I think the evidence suggests that we are enormously influenced by peer pressure, by socialization, by our genetic makeup, by a whole range of issues that have a very lot to do with how we make specific choices. St. Augustine, and I referred to him in an earlier lecture, said that we have only one basic freedom or choice, to choose to serve God or to choose to serve sin. He said that perfect freedom is perfect obedience. The one who is a slave to God is the only one who is perfectly free. I might here, incidentally, as I mentioned in an earlier lecture, notice that close analogy or parallel to the way we often think about the environment. We make the point that if we think we are free by exploiting and consuming on a grand scale, we may have a kind of freedom for a time, but it will be short-lived. That in actuality, the only way to be free in relation to nature over a longer period of time is to be, quote, obedient to, or at least orient our lives in relation to the various cycles of nature and the biosphere and so on. That freedom consists in a certain sense in obeying the ecological laws and principles, not in violating them. I think we have to grant that many of us are more than a little uneasy when we are told that human freedom is an illusion. For one thing, if nothing else, if freedom is an illusion, it makes it very, very difficult to understand why we take so much trouble to educate ourselves and to think about various social problems like the environment. Because if it is simply fantasy or illusion, we would do the same things, I think, in any case. It's a lot harder to take even our environmental foolishness seriously if we somehow are environmentally and genetically predisposed or predestined to act in those particular ways. Now, in the third place, we can think of human beings as responsible moral agents. And here, as Immanuel Kant so clearly recognized, we're really in trouble if we think of ourselves as fully a part of nature, at least if we accept a model of nature even remotely resembling that of the physicist or chemist, or perhaps even the biologist or ecologist. Actually, I'm not completely convinced that these various scientific disciplines really accept the same picture of nature. I'm inclined to think that they do, although occasionally I hear some disclaimers. Is the moral life really conceivable except as pure illusion within the model of nature accepted by the natural scientist? That's not an easy question to answer. And I realize that there are some who do accept that model of nature who still think we have something that looks like what we call freedom. I find that difficult to believe, that if everything that is ultimately a matter of chemistry and physics, a matter of atoms and motion and so on, it becomes difficult, for me at least, to understand how we could have anything that looks like freedom and moral responsibility. Fourth, perhaps the most fascinating single item to think about in connection with the relation of human beings to nature is that peculiar capability that Reinhold Niebuhr discusses so insightfully, the fact that human beings have the ability to transcend themselves, that they are able to think about their own thinking and doing. As the philosopher Hegel pointed out, and here I quote Gordon Kaufman again, a part of this lecture is based on his article. He says, the self is that peculiar kind of being, unlike any other of which we have experience, that is reflexive upon itself in such a way that it can become object to itself. We are not just thinking subjects who act in particular ways in relation to one another and the world about us, but we have this possibility, and it happens frequently, that part of ourselves stands outside the rest of us and thinks about who we are. Now, obviously, those are metaphors, but when we think about it, virtually all talk about God, man, and nature is metaphorical. We've realized in science that in physics, for instance, we've gone far beyond even the realm of picturability. We use models, and even more to the point, we use highly abstract mathematical symbols and so on. So I'm speaking in part metaphorically, but out of necessity, insofar as we never can be exact and precise in these questions. But the ability that we have to think about who we are, to make ourselves the object of our reflection, to become self-reflexive, this is a very peculiar ability that we have, and there seems to be not much evidence that other animals do this. Some glimmers of this, I think, in mountain gorillas and orangutans and a few other animals, but certainly on a very limited level. We are not only able to think or to perceive objects in the external world, but we can also think about the fact that we are thinking, and about the fact that we are thinking about the fact that we are thinking about the fact that we are thinking ad infinitum. There's the possibility here of a kind of maddening infinite regression. This whole issue of the possibility of an infinite regression, and I would comment that the philosophical issues here are very complex. It has been related by some theologians to the whole question of the existence of God, but that goes beyond the subject matter, or at least the time that we have, and I'm not going to try to comment further on that here, but there's some very interesting philosophy of religion that has been done in relation to that question. It's also a very interesting question within mathematics, although I think the mathematical problem is somewhat different from the philosophical. Now, this whole experience of our ability to be reflexive upon ourselves, I think, is fairly basic to the question, what is nature? And I want to return to that presently. Now, let's look at some specific meanings of the term nature. Actually, I'm not going to go through all 18 or 15. I want to focus on two in particular. And the first of these meanings of nature is rather straightforward. It's the nature that we think about when we're talking about wilderness, when we're talking about polar bears, saving the Amazon rainforest, when we talk about backpacking through the High Sierra. This is the nature that we're trying to preserve, and so on. I'm collating here or compressing a fairly broad range of meanings, but all roughly of the same sort. It's a manageable range. Nature here is understood, and I quote Kaufman, as distinct from the artificial, in quotes, activities of human beings who modify it and use it for raw material in the creation of culture. This understanding of nature sets nature apart from civilization or human beings or the artificial or other terms that we use to set off nature from civilization. It's in relation to this nature that we can, for instance, experience feelings of awe, mystery, incredible beauty, sometimes a sense of ecstasy. Some of these feelings are either essentially or closely related to the religious. One can even speak, indeed, of the worship of nature. This is the nature of Thoreau and at Walden Pond, or of John Muir in the High Sierras. This is the nature photographed so sensitively and creatively by Ansel Adams and Elliot Porter. This is also the nature we have in mind when we talk about saving polar bears or dolphins or the redwood trees. It is the nature we are thinking about when we speak of what is natural over against what is artificial, or, as was so popular in the last century, when we refer to the noble savage or the, quote, primitive tribesman of some distant continent or the glories of some long past golden age when human beings were in closer touch with nature, that kind of romanticism that was so powerful in part of the last century, dreamy world of the South Sea Islands or of some lost continent or some place where human beings were not so deeply corrupted by rationality and civilization, when they had this kind of harmonious, wonderful, primitive relation with the plants and animals, with nature. This is the nature that typically we contrast with civilization or culture. This is the nature also on the darker side of the ancient Canaanites who sacrificed their eldest sons to the nature god Moloch. Also on the darker side, I think it's closely allied, if not the same, as the nature romanticism of the Nazis during the Hitler period, or of Wagner and of Nietzsche, the focus on Blut, Boden, Volk, on the purity of the blood, on the soil, Boden, the earth, das Volk, the people, almost in a kind of religious, mystical sense. And we realize, of course, that there was a darker side to this sense of nature, because it resulted in such incredible suffering and eventually the death of 10 to 12 million Jews and Gypsies and Eastern Europeans. Now, obviously, I've run together a range of meanings here, but I think not irresponsibly so. For if there are differences in these various examples, they nonetheless fall within a broad range or family with much of the same meaning. In all of the examples I've given here, it is fair to think of nature in some sense as standing in opposition to, or at least in contrast to, civilization or culture. Nature is over against the artificial, the wilderness as contrasted to the city. Think of one of the very first articles we read in the course, the Merton article from Raids on the Unspeakable, the piece entitled Rain and the Rhinoceros. Now, when we speak of nature in this way and argue that human beings should stop polluting or ravaging or exploiting nature, then in some sense, at least, we see human beings and their activities as distinct from or over against nature. At the very least, I think you will have to admit that when we use nature in the sense I have just outlined, that is, nature as over against civilization or culture, it is difficult, if not impossible, to argue that we are fully a part of nature or can be comprehended fully within the category nature. And this is particularly the case if we define nature as not including freedom or quality or morality. Rather, in some sense, human beings seem to be acting upon nature. We appear to stand apart from or outside of nature when we use the term in this sense. Otherwise, these contrasts simply would not make much sense to us. How could we make the contrast between the artificial as standing for what we do as human beings as over against the natural, referring to all the rest? Now, let's look at another fundamental meaning of the term nature. This second meaning of the term nature is closely related to the meaning we sometimes assign to the term world, the German term Welt, W-E-L-T, which was very prominent in the thinking of Kant. And here again, I draw heavily on the Gordon Kaufmann article. According to the philosopher Immanuel Kant, and I warn you, some of the following 10 minutes or so is going to be fairly technical, but I see no way really to simplify this. If you want to understand the point, you're going to have to really follow closely because it is a bit technical. According to the philosopher Kant, and I'm quoting Kaufmann, the concept world, Welt, serves as an ordering principle or a regulative idea, an ordering principle or a regulative idea by means of which we bring all the individual and particular objects and events of experience into relation with each other and into a unified whole. He's talking about the concept of world. We'll see shortly that synonyms here would be terms like cosmos and universe. Kaufmann continues, he says, world is never an object of perception or experience. World is never an object of perception or experience. It can never, quote, come into view or be in any way directly experienced. It is rather the backdrop against which or context within which we have all our experiences and within which we know ourselves to be situated. He's drawing a contrast here now between the first sense of nature that I presented of the redwood trees, polar bears, and high Sierras and so on, and a second term which we refer to as world and which has the rough meaning of the terms cosmos or universe. Let me quote Kaufmann here in another passage. He says, if we treat the concept of world as fundamentally like other concepts which refer to or represent objects identifiable in experience, we get into insoluble antinomies, A-N-T-I-N-O-M-I-E-S. An antinomy refers to a contradiction between two statements, both that have apparently been obtained by correct reasoning. Something fairly close to this would be the reality in physics of light as waves or particles. We don't fully understand, I guess, how that can be, but we're compelled under different circumstances to accept both of those. Kaufmann says, if we treat the concept of world as fundamentally like other concepts which refer to or represent objects identifiable in experience, we get into insoluble antinomies. This is not only because, as Kant held, of the impossibility of conceiving clearly, not to say experiencing, spatial and temporal absolute limits. It is also because the world includes within itself all space and time as its abstract structure. This will help as we talk about world if you think of the terms cosmos or universe. And thus, all events occur within the world. But it is obvious that not all events are occurring simultaneously. Some have occurred and are over with. Some are yet to come. The world, then, which includes them all within itself, never exists as world. Only certain features of the world exist at any one time. again, think of the term cosmos. What he's pointing to here is that the term cosmos, world, universe, is not an empirical reality. You cannot experience the cosmos, in spite of Carl Sagan. You can't experience the universe because this is essentially an intellectual construct. Some of it is, in principle, unexperienceable because the light waves and galaxies and so on are shooting out in the other direction. Some of it is not capable of being experienced because it's not yet here, and so on. It's an intellectual construct that we use to order all of our ordinary experiences. Let me continue with the Kaufman quote. He says, "The notion of world is a construct created by the human imagination as a heuristic device." Heuristic refers to discovery, learning, and so on. "As a heuristic device to make possible the ordering and relating of all our other concepts or objects and events. It is thus indispensable to our thinking and even to the orderliness of our experience. And in every culture, we find some sort of often mythological notions of this widest context within which human life transpires. But it is itself not an object of experience. It is a fundamental presupposition of experience." Two comments. I'm intrigued by the parenthetical expression, often mythological, because I think there is a certain sense in which all thinking at this level is mythological. I think it's inevitably mythological to some degree, that we can't fully escape this. And then secondly, that this concept of universe is necessary to make sense out of the discrete experiences that we have. And he points to the fact that every culture has some kind of an ordering, overarching story or myth or concept that makes it possible for that culture to make sense out of the world in which they live. An interesting question that I wish we had time to wrestle with here as a kind of aside is the question, why is world or cosmos a construct of the human mind but not God? Why isn't God also a construct of the human mind, as Freud and others have argued? Well, the answer is that he may be. One possible answer on the other side is the answer that because God is seen as personal, active intelligence, God takes the initiative in revealing himself, and in that sense is not essentially a human construct. The revelation, so to speak, comes from the other side. But I, again, have to set that aside. It's a fascinating question, but not totally relevant here. Now, and here's where the two concepts of nature come together. The term nature, in many respects, functions like the term world and can be a kind of synonym for world or cosmos. As Kaufman points out, the term nature can stand for the totality of all events and objects, the whole within which all fall and of which they are a part. We indeed sometimes use the term nature to refer to everything that is, as a kind of synonym for cosmos or universe or world. But note that in the second sense, that is when nature is used in a way similar to the term world, then nature is no more perceivable than is world. It also is a construct of the human mind. When you use nature as a synonym for cosmos, universe, world, it is not an empirical reality. It is an ordering device, a framework device for ordering all your other experience. It is an intellectual, a human creation. The reason we frequently get into trouble with our term nature, says Kaufman, is precisely that nature, the term, is concrete in a way that world is not. Let me quote Kaufman once more. He says, "Whereas world refers simply to the totality, that is, cosmos, the whole, and thus to nothing directly experienceable, nature refers in addition to particular dimensions or qualities within the whole, to structures and events which can be perceived and experienced. We would never say that a tree is worldly, but there are no problems at all in regarding it as natural. Whereas to speak of laws of the world, that is of the cosmos, sounds exceedingly abstract and obscure. By laws of nature, we designate everyday experienceable regularities in, for example, light, sound, and gravitation. The fact that the term nature can be used comfortably in these very concrete examples in a way in which the term world cannot derives, says Kaufman, from the ambiguity in the term itself and the consequent semantic slippage that frequently occurs. That is, often in our discussions, we are using nature in two quite distinct senses and are not fully aware that that's what we're doing, and it's that semantic slippage between these two fundamental meanings that often gets us into philosophical trouble. Nature refers not only to the totality, but also in contrast with culture or the artificial, to certain features or qualities within the world, namely to that which exists and functions independently of human contrivance or interference, that which is other than the human, over against the human, sharply distinct from culture. Kaufman concludes this part of his discussion with this perceptive remark. He says, thus, although nature, like the world, is the overall context within which all that we are and experience have their being, it has an immediacy and experiential concreteness for us which the world does not and cannot have. Nature is experienceable as well as conceivable. World is only a concept. Nature is experienceable as well as conceivable. World is only a concept. We cannot experience the cosmos. We cannot experience the universe. We can't experience nature when we refer to the totality. But we can experience nature in its particularities. Okay, this, let me just take his concluding comments here. He says, thus, although nature, like the world, is the overall context within which all that we are and experience have their being, it has an immediacy, an experiential concreteness for us, which the world does not and cannot have. To repeat, nature is experienceable as well as conceivable. World is only a concept. It is for this reason, suggests Kaufman, perhaps, that nature can be regarded as the source and ground of all being and life. We use terms like Mother Nature, in a way hardly imaginable for the world. And so nature can come to have a kind of religious meaning and become the object of religious devotion and a direct rival to God in a way not possible for the world. Now this leaves us, Kaufman suggests, with a real dilemma. First, the concept of nature which Thoreau and Muir and others work with, the popular nature of the wilderness, the woods, the ocean, the rainforest, the high Sierras, this kind of nature, this reality can inspire awe in us. There is a sense of mystery. It has a kind of immediacy which makes it possible to think in terms of nature worship. But this concept of nature does not make it possible if we follow the scientific view of the physicist and the chemist, methodologically, this view of nature does not make it easy to speak very meaningfully of human freedom and moral responsibility, nor to speak of the peculiar nature of human beings as being self-reflexive. On the other hand, when the term nature is used like the term world to refer to the totality, then it is basically a mental construct and not an empirical reality. here it doesn't make much sense to think in terms of nature worship. That is, unless one wants to worship a construct of his own mind. Furthermore, such an analytical construct simply doesn't evoke a worshipful response from people in the way that nature in the other sense may do. The reason, incidentally, that in, say, Carl Sagan's Cosmos series, that there is a sense of the religious and a sense of worship at times is precisely because of the semantic slippage, that he's letting the term nature slip back and forth between two quite distinct meanings and seems totally unaware of this throughout the entire book and television series. And that, I think, results in the kind of conceptual confusion that pervades his writing on that subject. It doesn't make much sense to think of worshiping the cosmos unless we want to worship a construct of our own minds. When used like world, the term nature may be broad enough to include all aspects of reality, including human freedom, our sense of moral responsibility, and so on. But insofar as the term is a construct of the human mind, either one would have to admit that the human mind is the ultimate reality, which I guess few of us would care to do, or else one would have to posit some kind of cosmic mind or self, which puts the idea in our minds to begin with, again, a tactic which some of you may not want to employ. Also, it doesn't make much sense to think of worshiping this kind of nature, that is, attributing to it some kind of ultimate value, again, unless we want to worship a construct of our own intelligence. And furthermore, such an analytical construct simply doesn't evoke that kind of worshipful response from people in the way that nature in the first sense does. Now, this leaves us with a kind of interesting dilemma. One of the results of this, I think, is that it's precisely, as Kaufman points out, in this kind of situation that some kind of God language or God talk begins to make sense. Because, as Kaufman notes, the concept God attempts to do justice to the moral and historical and cultural dimensions of human existence. That is, God is seen as a kind of absolute self, as the ground of human freedom and moral responsibility. The nature, on the other hand, of the philosophical materialist or of the natural scientist who is also a materialist may provide an adequate paradigm for the more deterministic, mechanistic aspects of human selfhood, but such a paradigm doesn't really do justice, so the theist would argue, to the more personalistic aspects of human being. Now, incidentally, this problem was solved in antiquity in a somewhat different way. They generally, for instance, in much Greek thinking and, say, in the philosophy of the Stoics, did not employ the concept of nature used by most modern scientists. Their sense of nature was that nature also included purpose and meaning and beauty, a kind of teleology, so that when the Stoics spoke of living kata physin, according to nature, this had moral dimensions and did not just refer to our somatic physical existence. It was a meaningful expression to, say, live according to nature. The problem today, when someone says, I want to just follow nature or live according to nature, is you have to immediately come back and say, well, what do you mean? Is this the nature of the physicist and chemist? And if so, how can you live according to it? Because it is essentially valueless, and we can't think in terms of quality and so on, or moral responsibility. So when you say, I want to live closer to nature, what does that really mean? In many cases, I think it's a pretty empty expression that is actually filled from other metaphysical, religious, philosophical sources. I think the issue for us comes down to this: what are you, what for you are the most significant aspects of reality, including human reality? where do you find your deepest clues to the nature of being, including your own nature? I might add a final caveat, and that leaves us just a couple minutes for comments or questions. My purpose here is not to try to make God language intelligible or to persuade you of its truth. I think in that sense God can probably take care of himself, that is, if there is such a being. Rather, I'm trying to show you that the ways in which we use the term nature are not unrelated to traditional theological discussion about God, and that some, at the very least, I think God language is one way in which humans try to solve this kind of dilemma. So what I've basically suggested here is that you will not make sense out of some of the questions we asked on Thursday until you become more sophisticated. We all become more sophisticated in our use of the terminology. And as long as we let the term nature slip back and forth between the very particular meanings of wilderness areas and polar bears on the one hand and the other meaning of cosmos, universe, ultimate framework of reality, what we say just won't make sense. Are human beings a part of nature? Yes, if you are a philosophical materialist and use the term nature as a synonym for universe. This would be logically required. Are human beings fully a part of nature? For the theists, clearly no, at least for some theists, for Jews and Christians, Muslims and others, because God the Creator is not synonymous with nature, and God is the ultimate cause. Are we fully a part of nature? If so, we better stop using terms like unnatural. Are we fully a part of nature? Well, if so, how can part of us stand outside of the rest of us and make ourselves the object of our own reflection? Tough questions. I'm not suggesting any easy answers. The purpose here is simply to make us more sophisticated and cognizant of the different ways in which we use the terms so that when we use them, our thinking won't be muddled by this kind of semantic slippage. Any questions or comments? I realize this was fairly dense material, but I think it's absolutely essential to understanding the Joseph Sachs book and the Green Delusions book and some of the material that we'll be reading the last few weeks of the course. Jim?